Good evening. So I'm sure everybody here has a personal computer of some type. Because this is Silicon Valley, you could get arrested for not having a personal computer. But seriously, have you ever had a computer virus? Anybody not experienced computer virus? Well, they're very troublesome, as we know, and they create big problem when you rely on the PC or the Mac. Viruses are a big problem. They're a big problem because we depend, these days we depend so much on our personal computers. They're just a part of our life. Anyway, these viruses are very malicious creatures almost. They sneak in unseen by the eye and by the ear, by the mind, and they have been created to bring harm. They're created to corrupt. High-tech term. Virus will corrupt your computer. They pollute. You know, they like pollution and they make problems and they just disrupt. They just disrupt things. And when you get one, your computer becomes kind of useless. Can't respond to what you want it to do, and big headache. A virus will prevent us from doing our intended activity with the computer. So what we've learned to do, because we know of their danger, we now have a priority where we screen them, try to catch them before they can enter and pollute. We try to detect them and become aware of them and block them from creating harm so that the personal computer can remain clean, in a clean state. Now, our minds become corrupted in the same way. Like the computer, the mind is inherently clean, inherently uncorrupted, and our mind can naturally recognize what it needs to do and can naturally respond to what is needed when it is not corrupted. The mind will know what to do in the present moment. And this is called a giving mind. And it is inherent in all of us, inherent in all living beings, is this uncorrupted giving mind. But just like in the machine, pollution can creep in undetected and corrupt our inherent giving feeling. Now, in our practice, we sometimes talk about the qualities of the bodhisattva, the one who is awake. Six bodhisattva qualities, or paramitas, giving, patience, morality, vigor, meditation, and wisdom. And these qualities together constitute the bodhisattva's mind, which is a selfless mind and is directed towards others. And directed toward being fully in the world and being fully alive and taking care of the world. But this bodhisattva mind exists in human beings. We are human beings, and so it is possible for viruses to sneak in and to corrupt our selfless mind. Here are some of the viruses, human viruses, that I can think of. It's too much trouble. It's boring. I'm tired. Well, this is not my job. Somebody else can do it. It's not so important. Well, oh, this is good enough. And maybe the most famous, I can get away with it. I can get away with not doing it. These are viruses. These things creep into our mind and get in the way of our inherent giving mind. So how do they get in the mind, these viruses? In other words, what is the source of our karma that creates these viruses? With practice, with our continued practice, we will come to understand the source of these viruses. And more, we will come to recognize their presence. More and more, we will detect them as we continue our practice. So the important point for our life is our awareness, continued awareness. Awareness of these viruses and not allow them to corrupt our mind. Not let them attack the activities of our life and inhibit our selfless mind. So through our mindfulness practice, which is ongoing, we will come to recognize these so-called viruses. And we will learn how to stop them from taking control and prevent the mind from becoming oriented towards itself, but instead stay oriented towards the whole world and see the world in a large sense. So these days there is, we have software, virus prevention, virus detection software, to detect and remove the viruses and block them. And these software programs, they run in the background. You don't know that they're operating when you use your machine. You can't see them operating, but they are working to prevent the virus. The same is true with the awareness of our mind that keeps the mind free of corruption. It's like it runs in the background. It's there, working, our awareness. And when it notices the tendencies that could corrupt, it becomes hard to admit them. when we see our tendencies that we realize can corrupt us, it's painful. Oh, am I like that? That's hard. And when we do recognize such a tendency in ourself, then recognize this could be a virus that corrupts my pure mind, we have to make the effort, the big effort, to encourage ourselves to be continuously mindful, to beware of such tendencies, to do what we can to not let them corrupt, and to continue to have our mindfulness run in the background. That means we take our practice seriously. Because we recognize what a big meaning it has for our life. When we are practiced and skillful with our mindfulness, the mind will naturally prevent these emotional viruses. But if mindfulness does not run in the background, we will find that our daily life becomes corrupted. So to make an effort to remove a virus when we discover it, we have to be motivated to take action. This is true for mechanical and electrical things as well as our own human activities. The motivation starts with a problem, the recognition that something is corrupted, and the recognition that there is suffering. Suffering is resulting from this corruption, from this virus. So if in your everyday life you have a problem with your car, or something goes wrong at home, or you have some trouble with a friend, or trouble with your PC, any of these things can disrupt our life and can create anxiety. And so we want to fix this problem. And very often we have to spend some money to fix it if we don't have the skill. And so we might have to call on an expert. But spiritual suffering also creates anxiety and disrupts our life. And here is where the analogy stops. Our habits and our karma are not mechanical. And they arise because we are humans. And also because we are Buddha, already Buddha. We are not machines. We cannot fix our karmic tendencies by writing a check. And we cannot apply special techniques, and we cannot ask for outside intervention to help fix our problem. There is no software or hardware to fix our spiritual viruses. There's no firewall. There's no antivirus program. Mindfulness is our only intervention. this intervention means to wake up our Buddha nature. If we want to stay uncorrupted and free of viruses, we have to wake up our Buddha nature. And this is our practice. So our dedicated practice, continuous dedicated practice, the only way to respond to our karma. In other words, to preventing our mind from becoming polluted and prevent our life from becoming polluted. So we put we have to trust our own determination to live the bodhisattva life, and trust our own intuition and our own experience. We cannot trust techniques. Those are only for a machine. The worst thing we can do is ignore our karma, ignore our viruses. And the worst thing we could do is to ignore those tendencies that will pollute our mind. If we do ignore them, then our life is no longer Buddha's life. And the next worst thing is to go around looking for a fix outside. In other words, looking for somebody else to take care of our problem. Only we can take care of our problem. So it's necessary that we accept ourselves as we are, with our problems, with our limitations, with our habits and our tendencies, our karmic tendencies, and maintain the determination not to let them get in the way, to remain aware. Which is necessary to awaken our true nature. Because our Buddha nature knows what to do. Our Buddha nature knows what to do when we are exposed to all these viruses. It knows how to do the hard work. And if we if we don't understand the meaning of working hard, it's impossible to awaken our Buddha nature. So when we say work hard, working hard, it's not just physical or mental effort. Working hard is our continual and undiminished spiritual activity, always engaged. So when we sit, like we do tonight, we should sit down with the determination of the Buddha. If you know the story, Buddha's biography, you know that for several years he tried various techniques, studying with several different ascetic teachers. He finally gave up searching for the single one that would solve his problem. For 6 years he'd been on the search for the perfect solution. But he looked outside himself. He looked to somebody else to tell him how to do it. And he finally realized, I cannot look for a single technique to solve my problem or to solve the problem, to solve the universal problem that I want to address. Finally, as the story tells us, he simply sat down under the tree and relied on his own effort to make his own discovery. And as this story tells us, he woke up to the truth of himself and the truth of the entire world through his own effort. So external techniques, outside interventions, are sometimes necessary in our life to help us fix things. When we have an electronic or a mechanical failure or a plumbing failure, something like that. And sometimes if somebody has a very serious mental problem, we need an outside intervention. But outside interventions are not useful for expressing our true nature. Our sincere effort is the only technique there is to detect our karmic tendencies and prevent them from polluting our life. Does anyone have a question? Yes, please. It's an important question, because it is true that wherever you go on the earth, when you go to some place that is its own unique culture, everybody believes the same way. And you go to another place and their way of being is totally different than the other way.
So we do grow up being culturally conditioned. But then one day we wake up and we say, I've never even asked a question about how I should live. I've simply followed what other people have told me. When we wake up to that, then we start to make an effort to discover what's really true and not just what we've been told is true. So this is part of our practice, to wake up to our conditioning and to make some effort to find the truth despite everything we've been told. But if we have, an urge to live with the truth, then we will make that effort. Thank you. Yes, Bonnie.
I have a related concern. I don't know if I formulated it quite into a question, but I realize that we're constantly inundated by media and commercials and things. It's so much background noise we don't even realize that we become accustomed to this is normal, whether it's violence or portraying women as kind of weak, or it just so inundating. And I just found out, Prince just died, and so I'm just like watching videos of him and his life, and he mentioned something about wanting to know the truth and being conditioned. And he said something like, I found out George Washington wasn't even the first president. He was like number 8. And I was like, what? And I looked it up and it was right. And I was like, why do all the textbooks say George Washington was the first president and he's not the first president? And there's so many things, like as we're conditioned, history books, news, political campaigns. I wonder, is it designed to make us feel like we have power when really they're kind of all working together in some ways, it's hard to know what's real and what's fabricated, but at least becoming aware and questioning everything, you're ready for change when you see this piece of truth and then it flips and you see the rest of it or a different side of the story. I think having that ready mind to accept change quickly helps, but I do have a lot of concern about the amount of conditioning that we're being systematically conditioned, actually. Concerned about it.
Do you have a plan?
Do you have a platform?
You have a platform.
Seek truth.
Yes. Not be satisfied with it when you know it's can be misleading. Seek truth. So that takes some courage and takes some effort, because it's so much easier just to sit there in front of the thing and just not think about it. So it takes determination. It takes practice. Thank you. Yes, please.
I have this image that a bodhisattva is sort of always okay, like always happy, or at least never disturbed. Like they have equanimity. And one of the things you said is we have Buddha nature. We are bodhisattvas, but I am not always okay, and I guess. But it was also said, I think mentioned while we were chanting, sort of there is no ignorance, no attainment. And I guess I'm wondering there's no difference, but there also it also feels like there is a difference. I'm struggling with that.
A difference between
someone who's always okay and someone who is not always okay.
The Bodhisattva is not perfect. The Bodhisattva makes mistakes. The Bodhisattva gets confused. The Bodhisattva gets distracted. But the Bodhisattva knows how to come back, to recognize what's going on and come back. The Bodhisattva is always ready and is always ready to make an effort. But Bodhisattva is a human being and will get distracted, get confused from time to time, but because of his her practice, will know how to come back to the center. Just like when you sit in zazen and your mind, you start to follow your breath and your mind becomes very clear and very calm and undisturbed and there's nothing there. Then all of a sudden there's something there. What? Where did that come from? Wow. So you come back. So to have 100% free mind is not the point. Knowing and being willing to come back, that's the Bodhisattva's way. Thank you. Yes, please.
I was just talking about the computer and the virus and how disturbed we are when the virus suddenly, unexpectedly, hits us. I actually feel a little bit different in that way because, we have tools to prevent viruses, or if there is a virus, it can really image your computer. There are different ways. I think that virus is much handleable or manageable than there is a bigger virus, which is getting addicted to that computer. So the way I'm thinking is, we think that the trouble is somewhere, but if you can take care of that trouble, it's not really a destructive virus. It can be taken care of. And if you have a computer, I think it's obvious that there will be virus, and you need to be able to take care of it. But the addictions that go with the computer these days, I feel human beings are not human beings. They defend their addictions. Children get addicted to games or being on computer, talking to friends, so much that they defend so well for being there and totally not being mindful, or even adults behave the same way. That is the bigger virus, in my opinion. I don't know, that's my way of looking, because it cannot be taken care of easily. There is no tool. There is no tool to take care of that virus. And it is destructive, more destructive, because it just changes the patterns, lifestyles, make the person unable to perform. How do we take care of that virus?
Which one?
The bigger virus.
Bigger virus.
Which has no tool to take care of.
What's the name of the virus?
Addiction.
Addiction. Okay. So you have to notice that you're addicted. Oh, I've been doing this for 6 hours. Oh. I think I've become addicted. And you recognize it and you you make an effort to not be so attached, but to say, I'll do the work I need to do and then move, go do something else, and not just stay here and play. Play. So it's a matter of noticing and being aware and saying, uh-oh, this is not, this can be destructive, this is not creative. I have to make a shift. But it's a good point in that many people don't notice they're addicted, or they won't call it addiction. They won't call it that. They'll say, oh, this is very necessary. Whereas their friends, you as their friend and other people might say, it's too much time. That it's too much time, they're addicted. But she might say, this is necessary. That's how life goes. And that kind of addiction will turn up as a problem years later when somebody feels isolated, does not feel connected with other people, feels lonely, and wonders, how did this happen? It happened because they forgot how to have relationships except with machine. So that kind of addiction can have real problems later when it builds up. But it, like with anything that's new in our lives, we have to learn how to use it wisely. And we're learning that now. And we will make mistakes. Thank you. Yes, please.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm paraphrasing a bit, but I think you mentioned something along the lines of that our default nature is a giving nature, as long as we're not corrupted. And I like that idea. And there's a part of me that believes that and wants to believe it, and it's a very optimistic view of human nature. And I do think there's absolutely evidence that supports that. My question is, sometimes, for example, I'll watch children playing, and I'll see them give and be generous, but I'll also see 2-, 3-, 4-year-olds run and just grab toys out of other kids' hands and poke each other and do things at a very young age, you know, seemingly with no obvious corruptions. Or even with adults, I'll speak for myself, although I sometimes have very generous impulses and I'm happy when that happens, often I think, what are my needs? What are my desires? How do I get those met? And my sense is that there are some wonderful people whose default nature is to generally be generous, and there's also many, many humans who their first instinct is to get what they can. And then when that's satisfied, then they might be generous with others. And it makes me wonder, what does it mean to say something's a default or natural if we hypothesize that for many people or most people, being generous may not be the first impulse.
How do we return? Is that your question?
I buy into the idea that we all can be generous and we have that ability. I guess I'm wondering, what does it mean to say it's our natural state if much of the time we're not acting in a generous way?
We don't act in a generous way sometimes because of a virus. It's the greed virus, which is always trying to sneak in. So we just have to, you know, two things, I think. One is be mindful and stay alert, and the other is to be determined or make some kind of quiet vow to live the authentic life free of corruption. If we say, I want to live like that, then we are motivated to be on guard. On the other hand, if we say, well, I'm here to have a good time all the time, then we'd probably be selfish a lot of the time. It depends on our worldview and our attitude. Thank you. Oh, Columbine, please.
I just had a comment about that. So it seems like a lot of human nature is to kind of take care of the basic necessities, and that might be seen as selfish or greedy. Not the greedy that you were talking about, but I guess my point is just that I think of it as like when I went on a kayaking trip, my guides were very strong physically, and so they took care of themselves so that they could take care of us, and if anything bad happened, they could save us. So sometimes taking care of yourself gives you the ability to kind of save other people. So it's not always just like me, I think. Really.
Well, staying in shape is part of their responsibility towards taking care of others. Mm-hmm. Not just personal, not just to show off. Yeah. So taking care of others takes many forms, I guess. Thank you. Yes, did you have a question? Yes, Richard.
At the beginning, you listed several things like, I'm too tired, it doesn't matter, all these excuses by which we can become like complacent with ourselves and with each other. Mm-hmm. And they're like memes, like, accepted things to say and hear. You know, so that the virus is, it's interesting that the virus is language there, or the meme, and in computer the code is like a language of infecting the thoughts that then affect our attitude and our behavior. Is it fair to when we practice meditating or reading or like the chant, we recite the chant, can we think of that like a antivirus software? Or when we read Buddhist texts, that literature that motivates us, inspires us, and you know we gain knowledge, is that? I'm being a slightly facetious, but I'm serious at the same time. Is that a way to kind of combat the virus by reading?
The reading and the chanting and the ceremonies can encourage us to practice. To sit quietly and let our mind learn how to be a good detector. Those things are they're in forms of encouragement. But we don't stop there. We sit down and make an effort. Yes, please.
So, a little back to the beginning, we were talking about, you know, corruption and conditioning, all the stuff in the world, abusing the needs all over the place. We also talked about finding the truth, but do we necessarily need to sort through everything? Is it ill-advised to want to be removed from all the confusion and go back or go some place where things are simpler and not sort through all this junk that's coming in from everywhere?
Pretty difficult to go back. The challenge is to keep a steady and calm and aware mind in the midst of all this stuff and not be overwhelmed by it. So... if you're driving and you come to a intersection, the light is red and there's a car in front of you and the light turns green. The car doesn't move. The car in front of you doesn't move. Then we have a choice. Just calmly wait for the car to move or start getting mad and laying on the horn. We have a choice of how to be in this very complex world. So we watch ourselves and we come to understand that it's a lot better for our well-being if we stay calm and not let it overwhelm us. We live in a kind of hyper-environment, don't we? And if we don't want to be hyper, then we have to learn to calm ourselves. Thank you.
Bonnie. I've been thinking about your question, actually, and my own experience. It's a good question. In terms of, is generosity natural, right? And what I realize is I have all kinds of impulses and often conflicting impulses. And some say be generous and some say, you know, hold on and just you've given enough, like, you know, and some are like this and some are like... But when I think back, I can think back how I felt after I took action. So, for example, recently, someone that I knew passed away, actually was murdered, and I was with the family in the hospital while he's on life support. And I hadn't slept much the night before, and I was tired, and part of me said, go home. There's nothing else you can do. You know, you gave condolences. But then part of me said, no, I want to stay with the family until they take the body. I want to stay all night. And I stayed and I watched the baby. I held, they had some newborn babies and held them so that the family could all be together when they unplugged him. And I was tired, but it was like deeply fulfilling to be there, to be. And then I can think of other times where I've given into an impulse, like, you know, I know I should go to bed, and I don't go to bed. I stay up looking at stuff, and then the next day I feel like crap. You know, so I think there's always mixed input: do this, no, do this. But then when I think back, do I feel deeply fulfilled by the choice I made? Then I think if I do, then that was natural for me. And that was being authentic to what was needed at the time. That's been my experience.
Thank you. Oh, yes, please.
I guess going back to, like, also the beginning of the, I guess, conditioning of, like, culture and stuff that people go through. And how you said one day you'll wake up and you'll start questioning the things around you. While you're doing the questioning of the things that you think to know to be the truth, how do you know when you decide, oh, this is the truth? How do you decide that that's just not the conditioning somewhere deep in your mind, or a virus in your mind, I guess, telling you it is the truth? Like, how can you make the distinction between you actually questioning something and finding the truth versus you thinking you found the truth, but it's actually still something out there?
There's no user manual. But as you as your awareness deepens and your mind becomes more subtle, and it becomes easier to see those small differences, and you have a feeling of what's the best way to go, it's all within us to cultivate within us. There's no easy answer. You just have to keep working on it. Thank you.